Okay, Barbara, you can, let's turn you on. Any questions?
Yes. I have a question. In your vision of the future, you talked about all these evolutionary changes. In your vision, do we need our human bodies to participate in this, or will this continue with our glorified, resurrected bodies?
This is such a really interesting question, and nobody knows for sure. But here's what, I'll give you my intuition.
What's the question?
Say it again louder, please.
I was asking, in her vision of the future, do we need our human bodies to participate in these evolutionary changes, or will it continue with our glorified, resurrected bodies?
My guess is that we're heading towards light bodies that would have connection with superhuman intelligence that is already being developed through our computers, which is silicon-based life. It comes out of sand. And if you study anything to do with the computers and what they're going to be able to do, the theory of Ray Kurzweil is they're going to be, in some respects, trillions of times faster than human mind. Mm. But human mind and biological body, carbon-based body, are creating superhuman computers, and we're going to be probably residing in a solar system where we will start adapting our bodies to new environments. The bodies are perfectly adjusted to this biosphere, but they're not at all adjusted to extraterrestrial sphere. It could be that the reason really for the biological revolution, life extension, body transformation, cloning, all of that, is not appropriate for a biosphere. But is appropriate for an extraterrestrial sphere, and the solar system is just our baby testing ground. And there's a book called The Overview Effect by Frank White that I like a lot. He interviewed the astronauts when they were seeing Earth from space, including Edgar Mitchell and some of these really remarkable folks. And his thought is that we will speciate into new species, and that life ever evolving, life everlasting, will not be carbon-based life in a biosphere.
I have another question.
Yes.
So it seems like the Bible says at Jesus' second coming that life will be perfect, and so why would we need to evolve anymore?
It's really interesting to define the word perfect. If you're talking about life everlasting in the universe of trillions of planetary wombs, with the potentiality of learning ever more, and one of the things Buckminster Fuller said is the universe can never learn less. So I think that there are definitions of perfect, made whole, not static, nothing more. I would define it as wholeness and oneness with the creative intention of the universe at a threshold of such enormous potential that none of us can imagine it. And when Jesus said, I'm going to create a place for you and you can come too, I always thought that's where I want to go. But it wasn't, he said, in my Father's house are many mansions and I have many flocks. What does that mean? It, from an extraterrestrial point of view, it's probably true. And it's also probably true that any planet that goes through it becomes has an intelligent species would need to have a Christ figure come in to tell it exactly this. And that's a science fiction version of Jesus. But in my Father's house there are many mansions. And where did he go? to create a place for us with many flocks. So you really, really have to open your mind to what these words mean. They were defined by the current consciousness of those people. Mm-hmm. And another thing is a new book I was telling somebody called Thank God for Evolution, How Science and Religion Meet. And it is by Michael Dowd. It will be published in November. And Michael is just really wonderful because he was a Christian pastor, very much against evolution. Then he got, through a Buddhist, he understood evolution. And then he began to study with the scientists. And I went to a conference with him recently where we had real neo-Darwinian material-based scientists. And he's got his science so accurate. And he's showing it as a revelation of the awesome creativity of the divine. Anything we do to create these old limits based on words that were invented by people who lived in a flat earth before science is a vocabulary problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
Barbara, one of the things that relates to her question was one of, I'm not sure which part of scripture, but was we are God's children now, but what we will be has not yet been revealed.
Right. You have been children of God. You are to be heirs of God. Joint heirs with Christ. Is that from the Bible?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? You see, it's very hard to have taken any of that as the truth when we seem so limited. But what I got coming at it from a futuristic point of view is we're not that limited. But our language is limited, our dogmas are limited, our belief systems are limited, but we're not. Yeah.
I have like a lot of things to ask or some kind of ramble, but I thought it was interesting today. I didn't really know what to expect. I've heard your name before, and I have never read anything or listened to your speeches, but in just for the first 2 weeks of this group, it seemed like you talked a lot about life versus death.
I know.
That's an interesting observation. I don't, maybe it's just my interpretation.
Somebody just came up to me and said, you didn't talk about death. I
right.
thought that's
I don't know what that means. I don't know if it's even important, but just something to kind of think about. And then the question about gender. In the chapter of Metamorphosis, when you mentioned Mary Magdalene and that Jesus appeared to her and she really didn't know who he was, and they recount that story here, that, and then she, you know, Jesus says, Mary. And then she says, oh, okay, now I recognize
mm-hmm.
you. I was just wondering, like, I guess the question, this is kind of a maybe stupid and naive question, but about our voices. Like, our voice going to be able to, is that what it takes to, and then the next stage, the next stage it says, while they were walking and talking, I'm assuming these two guys, you know, they were talking with Jesus, Jesus came near and went with them, but their eyes kept them from recognizing him. So they had, you know, they didn't listen to him. So they had their ears, you know, they're trying to, you know, it's just interesting, this whole thing about voice and about auditory, like, what's going to remain there? So
what a wonderful question. I'll tell you what I think about voice. You know, all throughout history, humans have heard voices, higher level voices. And voice is a vibration from consciousness itself. And let's say when I had this experience, there definitely was vibrating in my head a higher voice. It wasn't clairaudience in the sense that I literally heard a voice, but I felt the vibration without hearing an actual voice. And there were times when my own voice, just as I'm speaking, I would begin to, if I shared this with anyone, particularly if I read from what the higher voice seemed to be saying, I would feel my voice going up to blend with it. And I would feel a shift in the voice frequency when one is open to the larger voices. And this is a theory that everything, nothing is lost. Not a hair, not a feather. And that there's another word for it in Hindu terminology that the scientists are now using. It's called the Akashic Field. The A field. And the thought here is that everything that ever happened in the universe is recorded in the quantum field, which is underneath matter. It's that so-called empty space is actually the repository of the experience of the universe. So how do atoms remember to make cells, to make molecules? It's all there. And the thought, some of these psychics like Edgar Cayce and others can see past lives and future lives. It may be because it's all there. And I tend to believe that nothing is lost. That all consciousness is available. And that when you're in a higher frequency of your own consciousness, you can tap into any part of the Akashic field. And some of the great yogis do this. But most of us have a limited consciousness, so we don't let it out. And people who take substances will say that. So my students, whoever they may be, what I see is that evolution is a consciousness-raising experience, from molecule to cell to animal to human to Christ and so on, that our consciousness as we sit here right now in real time is expanding. And the voices that we attributed to gods and higher beings is all available right now. And then our voice can be an expression of uniquely of what we pick up. And I think the voice carries the frequency of the divine. And for me, the audio, that's one reason I'm so concerned about these audio tapes in their lost.
Let me suggest, keep your hands away from the microphone, then.
Well, you could have told me before. Thank you.
Okay.
Let's have someone pass it out. Yes.
You were talking earlier about we can either destroy ourselves or evolve. And I remember another time when you talked, Barbara, you talked about how all our systems are broken, so much is broken, and politically in the church and all facets of that we live in. Can you talk some about what you do see working? Some scientists talk to you about things that can resurrect us?
Well, I mean, what's working, if you start with the simple all the way to the complex, is a huge amount. This is not just in the scientist.
Yeah.
Does this bother when I do this?
Be careful, that's all.
See, I think you can handle it. Let me just tell you this briefly, because I'm doing my next videotape, and I'm teaching, I'm establishing a field of conscious evolution next week at El Bosque, Casa de Maria under Wisdom University. I just like to tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
For years and years and years, I've realize there's a new field of which I'm an exponent, and I call it conscious evolution, but you can't go to anywhere to study it. And all the speakers are scattered, and they are all over the place. And so there is something called Wisdom University, which is a network university of different faculty members, and I was talking to his president. He asked me to do an intensive. And I said, you know, I really would like to establish, there's no field yet. You can't go to any university and study the evolution of our species, which is ridiculous. I mean, we're in a crisis of evolution and you can't study it anywhere. So he said, well, why don't you set up the field, Barbara? And we'll establish the first chair in conscious evolution. So I'm establishing the chair October 12th at El Bosque for a week. It's still available if anybody wants to register. You just go to Wisdom University on your internet and you'll find it, or email me and I'll let you know. What I'm going to do is lay out 5 days of co-creation that's going to encompass this thought, just touching on it. And I think it's the comprehensive framework for all evolutionary thought. And so in preparing for this, I've been thinking in social evolution, what actually is working now? And I'll just tell you very briefly, I've identified 5 categories. The first category is response to crisis. Environmental crisis, social justice issues. Paul Hawken has written a book called Blessed Unrest, in which he says he thinks it's the biggest mass movement in the history of humanity, and most of it's under the radar, and nobody saw it coming. He thinks there are over 2 million organizations now working. All small, all leaderless, all underfunded, not on the media, but working. That's number one. Number two, there's a large movement of understanding nature's wisdom. The Ecozoic Age, Thomas Berry, Brian Swinn. There's a whole field called biomimicry, where we study nature and then how to imitate nature in the way we build. There's a new great builder, architect called William McDonough, and his theme is cradle to cradle. Industry has to build in such a way that it doesn't leave anything that can't be recycled. It's like a tree. You know, a tree is perfectly designed. But our industry is designed, it's thrown off into the biosphere, it's killing us. Mm-hmm. So that's working. It's just started. Then there is the whole personal growth and human wellness. Self-evolution. Think of the enormity of diet, health, conscious parenting, conscious dying, conscious this, conscious that, yoga. If you were to map the number of people involved in some form of self-development, personal well-being, it would be, think of the book, millions and millions of people are involved. The third thing is spiritual evolution. That we're going beyond old dogmas into incarnating that divine intent within ourselves. Whatever our religion or lack of it, look at me. What happened to me? I am not that unusual. I just have made it my life purpose to express it, that's all. Mm-hmm. And then, let's look at social innovation. That would be things like microcredit loans, new educational systems, all of the different conflict resolutions, new ways of being and doing that are at the social transformational level. And then let's add to that quantum technology. Genetics, robotics, nanotech, space development, quantum computing, all of that. And you put that together, you'll see it's all happening now. But we have not had the breadth of vision or the ability to interact and connect as members of a planetary body being born. And I think I'm one of the first cells in the living body of planet Earth that went post-birth. In the modern time, I think a lot of great saints and seers went before, but they didn't have science, technology, evolution, or a planetary crisis of this scale. And Michael Dowd writes in Thank God for Evolution, he says in 25 years, he believes, all religions will be either evolutionized or archaic. It's like the Flat Earth Society. There may be Flat Earth Society, but it's truly archaic. If a religion continues in a very, very narrow interpretation of God, sitting on the right hand of God the Father, ascending, and in a universe, a cosmos of ever-increasing complexity and creativity, that archaic language will not hold. Certainly not for the younger ones. So I think, I forgot what the point was here. This, oh, what's working? Mm-hmm. So anyway, a lot.
I'm an agnostic and I've been very disappointed, sort of mildly, with the Bible and organized religion.
Yes.
And so when I hear you refer so much to Jesus and what he said, and that my understanding is that Jesus never wrote anything down, and much of the words that are attributed to him in the Bible very well may never have been uttered, you know, by him. So I see you giving so much credence to him, and I'm wondering how important Jesus, as described in the Bible, is to you and your thought philosophy versus what else we actually can see and feel and think about it.
You know, I've grappled with that a lot. I started out with no relationship to Jesus. I had a great question I asked in 1966. I'd been reading Reinhold Niebuhr on community, quoting St. Paul, all men are members of one body. And I just was taking a walk and I asked the universe a question. What in our age is comparable to the story of the birth of Christ? I wasn't thinking of Christ himself. I was thinking of the Gospels and the amazing effect of that story. Whatever actually happens, we'll never know. But we have to admit that the story, as written down, actually completely transformed the world. So I ask, what's our story? And what I got is our story is the birth of humanity as one living body. All right, so that was my first thing. It wasn't about Christ, but it was something about the story. Then in Mount Calvary, I had this Christ experience. I wasn't expecting to have anything to do with the Bible. But I had asked the universe the question, what kind of person could actually handle all this power? What's the image of a person who can handle biotech, nanotech, bombs, in space development? In our current mindset, we'll destroy ourselves with this power. And it was that question. My life has been guided by questions. Then I had this sudden Christ experience. I got this inner voice, and I began to notice through reading the Bible that from a point of view of what's emerging, there was much more truth to it than I had known. And because I began to have a personal experience of this, I wrote it down. And this is really an interesting little story I do want to tell you. As a futurist in the human potential movement, trying to tell about the evolutionary Christ was completely unpopular. Mm-hmm. I fell through every crack. You know, in the current culture, the futurist movement, I mean, you could say it, but it looked weird. The human potential movement, and like it, the agnostics, the atheists, the scientists, it didn't fit anywhere. And I published this book, and I was funded by Lars Rockefeller, who saw something about this, and he said, you know, I think this is bringing forth the Christ of the 21st century garden. And so I accepted the funds to publish this, although I had a real publisher, Lars Rockefeller guy. And then I didn't know what to do with it. I couldn't find a place, a base. Because if you go into an ordinary church, it isn't it. I could go into the New Thought churches. But they weren't as Catholic as you are. They didn't really believe anymore. And that's what I told you as I came in here. I thought, maybe what the Catholics have held on to is something so precious, but the interpretation of it in any dogmatic language will go. But I feel attuned to this, and so I don't defend it in terms of what did and what didn't happen. I got it from a personal experience. And probably that's the best way to get it. You know, I didn't get it from the book. I got it from the reality, and then I noticed what's in the book, and I saw it as signals of this. That's all. And the people who wrote the gospel down, the gospels then created Western civilization. Western civilization created the power to actually carry out and do the work. Now, if you want to look at meaning from a distant perspective rather than anybody's dogma, you'll be amazed. It's a discovery, and a lot of people do not agree with this at all. But I'm happy to be with a group of Catholics that I rarely get to be with, who, some of you maybe, would like to hear this. Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Barbara,
yeah.
I like your optimism. You are potential at the time. But if we believe the Jungians, and you say that shadow is the intrinsic part of our being, do you believe that we can only achieve this by somehow overcoming or annihilating it? Look at the media right now. That's all we need. try to develop. They sell what appeals to the dark side of mankind. And that includes our corporations, our politics, just what appeals to people. So at which point do you think there may be a shift where, or what would help?
Well, first of all, from a union point of view, it's absolutely essential that we acknowledge the shadow in ourselves. That's the beginning of the next stage of evolution, because if we project the shadow only on others, we'll never evolve.
Mm-hmm.
So step number one, and I'm sure this is very intrinsic into any great spiritual path, is noticing the shadow in yourself. The minute you put the light of consciousness on the shadow in yourself, you also can't fall into total self-judgment such that you lose all faith in yourself. So you have to get some sense of your own potentiality while you're acknowledging the shadow, bringing it to light, and all this personal growth and spiritual evolution is about dealing with it. All of the activity, all that, it's really there in everybody. And the media, you're right, is almost reptilian. It's exaggerated, but it doesn't show the potential. So I think it's perfectly right. See, the media doesn't really show what's wrong. And they don't really show what's emergent. They show what's sensational,
mm-hmm.
what's divisive,
mm-hmm.
what's shocking, what's painful. They're very infantile. And so I think that, personally, I believe that because we are aware now of so much of the shadow, that there are millions of us who say this is not acceptable, that we are killing our environment, going through a mass extinction, that billions of people are hungry. So maybe we had to get that in order for those of us who want to take a jump to have something to jump from, rather than thinking everything is just fine, like I did as an American in the 50s and 60s. I thought America was absolutely wonderful. Everything he did was great. It was wonderful that we dropped all those bombs. I think of my own consciousness having shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just watching this thing, The War. Has anybody seen that?
Yeah.
It's really, really touching how we have done this over and over again. There's a book by James Hillman called A Terrible Love of War.
Yeah.
And that tells of the psychological reality that ever since we got surplus in agriculture, we've been slaughtering each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us who are going the next step, the thing that's really true is it's a crisis. And maybe it has to be as bad as it is. Because if religion could have done it, if meditation and prayer could have done it, we would have done it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going on what I'm noticing, not that I have a big theory about it. Yes?
Don't you think that wholeness involves integration of the shadows? And
yes.
In our collective consciousness, it may be the crisis of global warming that forces us to integrate our shadow so that we don't continue to destroy the environment and do those things which are destructive.
I think that's true. I think that's exactly right. My friend Elizabeth Satoris, and she's spoken with you, I know, she feels that the global warming and the rising of the sea and the having to move cities uphill, you know, it's totally mind-boggling to think of that. She said what it will do is it will stop the military-industrial complex from making war to having to move people uphill.
Mm-hmm.
And having to move people uphill will require cooperation. Remember how at the time of the tsunami, different ones that had been fighting each other, including the U.S., suddenly had to cooperate?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it happens in crises all the time. Well, let's say this is a slow motion crisis, and not so slow. Evidently, the Arctic is melting faster than anybody could believe. Some of the physicists inform me that the sun's activity is heating up. It's not only human activity. It's the sun's is heating up, and it's inevitable now that the seas will rise. And the thing that's very unusual, in contrast to a tsunami in Katrina, is we know it. And all this economic growth impulse to get out, to keep growing, to keep not to deal with global warming. It'll go away. You see, this is the human species' big lesson. We absolutely had to have a lesson of this scope, clearly. We wouldn't, I mean, people like us might have chosen to do it willingly, but apparently the self-interest of the power structures of the world will not do it unless they're dislodged. I think during this next 5 years, and I just put a target date due to the Mayan calendar that December 22nd, 2012, we should have a target date for the first planetary smile. And that's my code word for the awakening of the Christ consciousness in billions of people connected simultaneously. I was on a meditation call last night with hundreds of people doing mass global meditation, and I put forward, let's think the thought, the planetary smile. That's my code word for the Christ consciousness. You can't say to the entire world, let's have the second coming of Christ. But if you say the planetary smile, then people who know about Christ consciousness can do it, but all of us can do it. You see, we have to transcend those things that divide us in language. Yes.
How might something destructive like fundamentalist Islam evolve in the kind of directions you described?
Well, this is a very interesting question.
And fundamentalist Christianity.
If you ever saw God's Warriors on Christian or on CNN. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for noticing. I'm about God's Jewish warriors, which is pretty bad. Then there's God's Christian warriors, and then there's God's Islamic warriors. They're all bad. And bad in the sense that they're divisive, they are messianic, they think only their version of God, and they think the others are wrong. And they're ready to die and kill for it.
And it's the smallest.
It's the smallest, and it's the violence that all of that seems to... So I've asked myself, I was shocked in my understanding when in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I thought we were heading for the global village. I was in that generation of seeing all the positive, we're one planet, we're one body, all of that stuff. Instead, we've had this nationalism, ethnicity, and fundamentalist religion, which is the most virulent form of this. This is my intuition, that until the human species gets attracted to what's actually emergent, the regressive fundamentalists will take over, because they have a transcendent vision. And the liberal religions do not. The materialistic scientists do not. The science fiction writers see nothing but war. I feel those of us who can help create a vision of what's emergent and creative and make it attractive to our species is absolutely the only alternative to fundamentalism. Because I think we are transcendent. And if I didn't know what I know, I couldn't be, I tried to be an existentialist and believe there was no meaning. I really tried it when I went to Paris in 48, 49, and I was obviously very depressed that the entire universe was going down to a heat death and I was the only person to give it meaning for me. I couldn't do it. So when I found all this, I could. Yes, Ed?
Well, I thought a lot about the things that you've come to speak to us about, that, you know, science, I was thinking about how the Earth formed from the explosion of a supernova and all of what followed that gave birth to how we are ourselves. And so I'm thinking, when you're talking about the Christification, you know, I'm thinking of the Earth. When we reach a level of Christ consciousness, that the amount of energy of that self-giving to one another, that real loving one another, that would be the second coming, in the sense that the intensity of that kind of energy of union would make us explode into a supernova. Then we wouldn't have to send a ship out there in space. We would become the little, we would all be blown out and become the little imaginal cells that would begin to swirl and create whatever the new form of this infinite source of creativity would become, but something like that. So where is death in all of this? It's all through it. The only way life comes after life is by dying. That flows our control and power over how we know ourselves to be and not being able to think we could be anything more or different or greater. But, I mean, it's open-ended because we have no idea really how the earth wasn't meant to last forever.
Right.
And because the sun is already...
It's going to expand and destroy all the planets eventually.
Right. So, you know, there's... I mean, I think to explore these types of things, considering life after life, is great. Anyhow, I'd like to go out in a supernova. I don't want to cancel what you are learning, and I think it would be a great opportunity for who we know ourselves to be in God to explode in. Oh, that's like an egg hatching. Exactly.
That is a beautiful, beautiful image there, Alice. You know, I think of the earth as a womb giving birth to a new life form. And the life form, you say, what kind of body will it have? She's more like that. A life body is not a bad image for exactly what you're saying. And I was researching that every religion has some view of the resurrected body. It's not just the Christians. It's just that Christians made the story out of it, that we're aiming there. And I think that's true. And we don't know, but I want to say just a word about death in that sense. It has occurred to me that revelation is unfolding in evolution. And that what have been metaphysical interpretations or intuitions are actually going to be evolutionary choices. And when I first caught hold of this, I was speaking to a group of people because I had just been with Jonas and stamp out physical death and all of that. And I said to this group of people, I think maybe death will be a choice. Some people may actually choose to die in an animal body. Others may choose life extension. Others may choose to go up into outer space. Others may choose God knows what, literally. And one person was really angry with me. And she said, are you trying to play God?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, I wasn't. But that phrase, play God, is exactly what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We are tiny godly, created in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing God in a kindergarten or in a womb, practicing godhood, co-creative godhood, not God of the entire cosmos, but co-creator God, in the image of someone who can love this. So that's why I see the story about Jesus, whatever happens, is actually the right story, but it narrows and then can become fundamentalism and dogmatism, and then it won't be able to fulfill itself. But that's your great image, Alice.
I'm sorry that I was it like
okay. And Alice, can I just say that I have my books there. I'd like you to sign my mailing list. Anybody who'd like to keep in touch with me as we go through this next stage.
Yes.
If you buy that little DVD called Our Story, it's right there on the table. It's my current first one. It will tell this story in very artistic, musical, simple terms. I think it's the thing to get. I definitely think you should get that.
Well, I want to thank Barbara for coming, and I hope you can see the importance of bringing other disciplines into our understanding of our faith. It's only to explore and to ask questions, which Barbara said she's been doing all along. It's the asking of the questions and the willingness and openness to knowing that God is co-creating in many different ways that we're going to grow ourselves. So it's not about taking everything Barbara says and having to believe everything, but what's resonating with you, and actually taking a good look at what's disturbing you also, and that way we grow. So I want to thank Barbara for
her expansive vision that helps us all to get outside that box.
Thank you.